that initial presupposition of our ordinary banality. That in a way, everything is human. That is anthropic. Okay? Now, the second central presupposition which underlies again all our thinking, yes, about our life and surrounding circumstances and the whole universe. The first, anthropocentrism. The second, let us call it rationalism. All of us, we are sure or want to be sure, desire to be sure, that our society, our life, my own life, and in a way, the life of the universe, yes, is arranged in a rational way, yes. From the Buddhist point of view, it is absolutely childish idea. But the most important European, and by the way, very many Eastern philosophers are rationalistic. That is, proceed from that rationalistic presupposition. That all can be explained rationally. And if it cannot, then what? It
doesn't exist.
Sorry?
It does not exist.
Oh, in what philosopher, quick? In which philosopher? Hegel, yes.
Sure.
That what really exists is rational. Only rational is really existing. Exactly, my friend. But you know, the very term, rational speaking philosophically, has two aspects. Let us call it objective aspect and subjective aspect. Objective aspect is what? That there is a certain, objectively, that is not depending on our thinking, yes. There is, everything is objectively, rationally arranged. And our business, our task, is only with our thinking, rationally comprehend that universal rational arrangement. You understand that? The great champions of that idea were even such great philosophers as Immanuel Kant and Georg Friedrich Wilhelm Hegel. From the Buddhist point of view, the idea of rationality or of the rational in both its objective and subjective aspects is one of the greatest illusions or mistakes of our thinking. Because it is in terms of modern physics, it is a very elementary extrapolation of our conviction about the rationality of our own thinking, and we extrapolate it to the whole universe, that it is arranged rationally. It is a second essential presupposition. Yes?
What did you mean by subjective rationalism?
Which subjective means not only the whole universe objectively is arranged rationally, but my own thinking can conceive of it rationally. It is subjective. It is my own thinking. That is objective rationalism of the whole universe, yes. It's thought of by me as a subject, subjectively also rational. Now, so the first presupposition, the first general intellectual attitude is anthropocentrism, the second rationalism. Now, it is not enough. what is extremely important for our understanding of Buddhist philosophy is that, apart from its anthropocentrism and rationalism, our thinking, when we think of ourselves, of our country, God save it, yes, if he wants to, of course. You cannot force God, yes, to save anything, yes, yes, you know, but also what is very important, that it presupposes a kind of universal ethical attitude. This is very important. The third presupposition. Universe and our own human universe, including human history, that they are arranged in such a way that we can, yes, what? That we can interpret all events ethically. In our thinking, in our everyday thinking, very often ethical aspect predominates. Yes. It's predominant very often.
It's an illusion.
Sorry?
It's an illusion, just like
the from a Buddhist point of view, it is an absolute illusion. Why? Because from the Buddhist point of view, speaking of the universe as it is in Sanskrit, yata bhuta, is neither bad nor good. Remember it. Without that, Buddhist, the only ethical postulate of Buddhism, I mean Buddhist philosophy now, well, it is as it is. Its goodness or badness, yes? Yes, is not in the universe as it is, but in what? Our evaluation of the universe. We always are confusing our thinking due to our ignorance mainly. Yes, with that universal arrangement. And that is why, from the Buddhist point of view, it is simply ridiculous. How in various other religions there are permanent discussions about what? I mean, the main anthropocentrist religions of the world, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. Most favored discussion is whether the man is primarily good or bad. Yes. So even within Christianity, some sections of Christianity insist on what? That man is, before Adam's fall, yes, what? Good, primarily good. But I do go and ask Scottish Presbyterians, yes, what will they answer? Man is utterly bad, and everything about man is bad. The first person in the history of human thought who tried, non-Buddhist person, who rethink it was Immanuel Kant, of course. To great displeasure of Hegel. Hegel hated Immanuel Kant's ethical ideas. Immanuel Kant, who invented the notion of what? Categorical imperative. Categorical imperative. I would have said the decisive step was made by Kant, particularly in his critique of practical reason and in his last book on religion. It's a very, very interesting. We may even say the only exception from that absolute majority of European and Eastern very often to thinking about that ethical alternative, the good, the evil, the goodness, the badness. While from the Buddhist point of view, the man is, as well as the whole universe, is neither good nor bad. It is only our own thinking makes it good or bad. But from this follows one very significant philosophical conclusion. Please?
Wouldn't you say that, like, something like Shakespeare made before God was saying?
I don't know. I like now your interference for one reason, because very often some most interesting philosophical ideas we see expressed in literature and in poetry.
Because he says in Hamlet that the mind can make heaven and hell.
Not only in Hamlet. There are several absolutely brilliant remarks about that in The Merchant of Venice and in the King Henry's Chronicles, you know. Probably it is in the intellectual, I would have said, strange and interesting Elizabethan intellectual atmosphere, not only William Shakespeare, but a lot of other poets and playwrights came upon some, for that time, strange philosophical ideas, and particularly ideas consonant with the conception of ethical relativism. But in Buddhism, ethics is absolutely relativist. Well, we are what we are. But it is by the strength of our thinking, yes, we may become either good or bad or what? Indifferent or neutral, as I told you. Because the only real ethical criterion in the philosophical Buddhism is what? Criterion of karmic consequences. But it applies only to human thought. And now, yes?
Does the, inquiry...
No, in Buddhism, you know, unlike Kantianism, where it definitely does presuppose, in Buddhism there is no such presupposition. But why? Now, listen, it is philosophically very important. Why? Because, for instance, let me give you an example. You slapped somebody's face, yes. And then that somebody, it happens, yes. Very seldom does it happen in the universe, but still, it does happen from time to time. But, you know, and then, of course, rumors and whispers, you know, he bloody deserved it, yes, or no, poor chap, yes, etc., etc. What is very important here, from the point of view of Buddhist philosophy, to evaluate the ethical value of that action of yours. Don't worry, no, it's not about personally, yes, don't do that, for heaven's sake. Yes, but that ethical value, which is in Buddhism, is always connected with the idea of karma, cannot be established by yourself. Only somebody else that is a trained yogi can say, my girl, it was a bad action. Yes, or on the contrary, but what is of extreme importance here, and I try indeed to remember it. Because in Buddhism, or not in Buddhism, forget, in the Buddhist philosophy, if we take some religious Buddhist texts, it is of course a bit different. But in Buddhist philosophy, any action, any behavior as such is neutral, is indifferent, ethically and karmically indifferent. What really matters is thinking that accompanies that action or that behavior. That is all, practically, all behavior, all life is again what reduced to thinking. And by the way, from this point of view, any human action taken as such, is as ethically different, indifferent, as thunder, yes, or hurricane, yes, or any event in nature, in the nature, yes. You understand that, yes? Now, so, let me return to what I started with. That is it. The necessity to change our intellectual attitudes with their essential presuppositions. Here I enumerated three: anthropocentrism, rationalism, and ethicalism. Okay, now, second point in today's lesson. In any Buddhist philosophy, I mean in any school of the Buddhist, there were dozens of schools, of various schools, with a great diversity as regards philosophy, and particularly as regards religion. Now, so in practically any Buddhist philosophical text, we see an especial category, the category of mistake. Well, mitya in Sanskrit and mitya in Pali, and it is sometimes viparyasa, but doesn't matter, don't try to remember those words, yes. But what is very interesting, that the idea of mistake or perversion in Buddhist philosophy, again, has its strength only as regards thinking, thought and consciousness. The idea of error, mistake or perversion, you may render it into English in three, more or even more than three possible ways, cannot be, speaking terminologically, applied to human or anybody's action, but only to thinking. Because action as such, without thinking, cannot be thought of by us as true or untrue, right or wrong, correct or mistaken, yes?
Is that what thought accompanies action?
Sorry?
Is that what thought accompanies action?
Please.
Is that what thought accompanies action?
Yes, it is, because thought accompanies action, and the latter is always reduced to the former action, to thought, in any philosophical discussion. Yes. Now. Yes. Louder, please.
Is the perversion of thought possible without action? Is the perversion of thought possible without action?
Now, a very pertinent, question. The answer, in principle, yes. It is possible. It is. More than that, in fact, three levels are established in this context and in this connection. Level of thought, level of temper, speech, and level of passion. And here it would be particularly important to stress one point. So, from our point of view, normal point, yours and mine, from our point of view, there are wrong ideas and right ideas. There are wrong views and right views. And here we see the radical difference of the Buddhist attitude towards views. Because, yes, of course, in our practical empirical life, our views may be wrong or right. The main criterion of rightness or wrongness of our views is what, for us? Their correspondence or non-correspondence to what? To what? Exactly. Louder, please. Tell the whole class.
External rules.
Or external things. Or external course of events. Yes. Speaking from the point of view of the Buddhist philosophy in general, all views of whatever kind are regarded as wrong. The very idea of point of view, the very idea of conviction as such is a wrong idea.
Isn't faith a conviction?
Sorry, isn't what?
Faith.
Well, it may be a conviction, but a faith in a Buddhist parlance, Sanskrit, Shraddha, can be also correct faith and incorrect faith. Well, but condition also, this conviction is also may happen to be correct, but the person on the path is regarded as the person who, in the first place, first out what is highly skeptical of all his convictions. It is the first stage, highly skeptical. In the second stage, he or she suspends all his or her convictions as playing no role in his attempts but to march on the path towards nirvana. So, on one hand, in Buddhism too, there are right ideas and wrong ideas. But in principle, on the other hand, all ideas, all points of view, all convictions are essentially, Andrew, wrong. Because the real energetic dynamic thinking what? When one has convictions. Why? Why think more about that? I am already convinced, yes. Conviction is usually what? Stopping of thinking. Do you agree with that, young man? If I am convinced, yes, of something, I think more about that. Remember those three stages. First, skepticism. First of all, about your own convictions. It is very easy to be skeptical, yes, about Mr. Bush's convictions, yes. It is worthless, yes. Try to be skeptical about your own. Then second stage, suspend them. And third stage, but it is almost always necessarily connected with your yogic dream. Then dismiss it, yes. Well, you know, yes, you are speaking of unhappy consciousness or unhappy conscience. you know, in fact, consciousness as such, not conscience. Our conscience is by definition. Yes, ladies and gentlemen. But you know what is extremely important from the point of purely philosophical Buddhist Buddhist idea of consciousness as the only subject of suffering. If there is no suffering consciousness, then what? There is no suffering. It would be ridiculous to say anything about suffering. Yes?
What was the third one that actually got to it?
Sorry?
The third thing that you were talking about as far as skepticism and renunciation?
Then suspension. Suspension, well, you know, no. Let me stop thinking about this for the time being, yes. And then, or a dismissal.
So there's a rejection and then dismissal?
Yeah. Or rejection or dismissal. And you know what is philosophically very important, ladies and gentlemen, is that it is intrinsically connected with the early historical Buddhism as philosophical, religious, and intellectual movement based mainly on ascetic renunciation. And that is why, let me now return to this problem. Yes, you know, ascetic renunciation can be observed in any world religion.
Yes.
So, particularly in the early Christianity, where the world is considered what? Sinful. Dirty. Bad. And the devil was appointed the prince of this world. Yes, in Christianity. From the Buddhist point of view, as I have already told you today, the world is as it is. It is you. You, yourself, that make it. Bad or good. Real or unreal, because of your thinking. And renunciation as one of the basic stages in the Buddhist path towards nirvana. And now remember it, because it is of extreme importance and very often omitted in modern understanding and teaching, by the way, of Buddhism. The Buddhist renunciator, the Buddhist ascetic renouncer, he leaves the world behind, not because the world is bad. Yes. Try to be skeptical about yourself. Probably it is I am bad, not the world. Yes. No. The Buddhist ascetic shramana, a bhikshu in Sanskrit, leaves or renounces the world, because his or her is quite another path, yes, without any hostility. An ascetic who renounces the world, cursing it, yes, is not a real ascetic in the Buddhist philosophy. Because a real ascetic is he or she who has already worked out what? An absolutely neutral, indifferent attitude towards the world. In one of the latest sutras, even the Buddha himself complains. He was no great complainer. He didn't like complaining. But in that sutra called Mahaprinibbana Sutanta, Buddha, well, complains to his pupil that now this city, this great city of Pataliputra is too noisy, yes, and impedes his yogic concentration. According to the archaeological research, the maximum population of Pataliputra was between 900 and 1,200. Can you imagine? But again, it doesn't matter. Because today, a future ascetic to be may well complain about Manhattan or about the slums of Los Angeles or about the Park Street in Greenwich. Too many too many factors detracted him from his deep Buddhist meditation. Now, okay. While in fact, again, Greenwich and New York are what they are. And all the stages of ascetic fast presuppose the renouncer's own discrimination between various thoughts concerning his human conditions, which cease to be, have already ceased to be human conditions and have already become what? Ascetic conditions. It is very important, bear it in mind all the time, that the so-called early historical Buddhism was essentially a highly elitist ascetic movement. Yes, that is why, yes? Well, now, the answer is, now, it is very, very pertinent question. You know, again, it varies depending on what? No, depending on whose body and whose mind we are talking about. In Buddhism, we have three different answers to this question. Thus, a normal body and normal mind. Everything is and body, all bodily functions or mental functions, modifications and modalities in a normal man are spontaneous. Then, if the man is a trained yogi, whose training of mind had already prepared him to change some main bodily conditions, it is a different matter. Because in a trained yogi, there is nothing spontaneous. And body is subordinated to mind. Yes. And the third stage, what? Super yogic stage of the Buddhahood, where there is not any longer that which is regarded in the Buddhist philosophy as subject of consciousness. There is no consciousness and no mind. So the problem of body-mind relations on the level of Buddhahood has already become separate. Because as it is formulated in other Buddhist texts, you will read some of them a bit later. Yes, Buddha's mind is no mind. Buddha's body is no body. Oh, there's no body. It is a special kind of body and a special kind of mind which cannot be compared with our body and our mind. Particularly in the works of the greatest Buddhist philosopher of the 3rd century AD, Vasubandhu, according to whom body and mind, their main difference is the difference in the composition of dharmic configuration. That is, again, both body and mind are reduced to momentary, instantaneous flashes of dharma, 3 minutes smoking. Mm.